Knowing your Old Testament makes you a better reader of the New Testament. That's something that Martin and I both believe very firmly, which is why we recorded these upcoming two episodes about how the New Testament utilizes the Old Testament. We hope that this conversation is helpful to you, and thank you for joining us.
Hey guys, welcome to this week's episode of Pocket Theology. Jason and I, two college friends who just decided to start recording conversations we have, are going to be talking today a little bit about the New Testament use of the Old Testament. And this is actually a really interesting conversation that Jason and I have had multiple times. Part of it is because Jason really likes the New Testament and I really like the Old Testament. So we represent kind of both parts of the Bible, I guess. But I'm a huge Old Testament nerd. He's a huge New Testament nerd. And today we're just going to kind of talk about the role that the Old Testament plays in our New Testament. So on that note, let's go ahead and get started. So Jason, is there only one way that the Old Testament is interpreted in the New Testament?
No. Next question. No, there's not. I'll elaborate a little bit. The New Testament can sometimes use Old Testament scripture in ways that makes a lot of sense. Like you read the New Testament passage, you read the Old Testament passage, and you go, yep, I get it, moving on. Other times it uses something as an illustration, which still might make sense to you, just depending on who you are, you know, and how comfortable you are with literature in general. And sometimes you're going to get parts of scripture that if you're familiar with how they're interpreted by like non-Messianic Jews, and then you read how Christian authors use it, you're going to be like, that's not what that passage meant, which gets pretty confusing pretty quickly and troublesome for a lot of Christians. So we'll get into some of that. But yeah, short answer is no. New Testament uses Old Testament in a ton of different ways, but in every case considers it authoritative.
Okay, so let's talk about a couple of those ways. Do you have any examples that you want to pull from or ideas you want to start out with?
Yes. In Matthew 21 is a great example of using an Old Testament text where the original message is basically maintained. Like the original meaning of the text being paraphrased or quoted is pretty much being maintained. Now, there is one little note I need to make here before we read the passages, which is ancient writers didn't necessarily do quotes like we do quotes. They much more often did paraphrases, and they might even paraphrase something and quote multiple sources and then just attribute it to like one prophet, which is interesting and definitely not what we do today. So this is actually going to quote both Isaiah or paraphrase both Isaiah and Jeremiah, but it's not going to be attributed to anyone. But Jesus's own words in Matthew 21, verse 13, he's in the temple chewing out a bunch of people for not behaving the way they should and taking advantage of people and basically stealing people's money, scamming worshipers out of their cash. And Jesus turns to them and says, "It is written, my house will be called a house of prayer, but you are making it a den of robbers." So the verses he's referencing here are from Isaiah 56 and Jeremiah 7. Isaiah 56 says, "These I will bring to my holy mountain and give them joy in my house of prayer." So that's a reference. Holy mountain is Zion. Holy mountain is Jerusalem, which is built on a hill, right? On a mountain. And the house of prayer is the temple that will be built there. So, or has been built there in Isaiah's time. "So I will bring them to my holy mountain. I will give them joy in my house of prayer." So Jesus obviously quotes that. "It is written, my house will be called a house of prayer." So he's paraphrasing, quoting, you know. And then he also references, you know, you've made it into a den of robbers, which is from Jeremiah. "Has this house," this is Jeremiah 7:11, "has this house, which bears my name," again, the temple, "become a den of robbers to you? But I have been watching, declares the Lord." And so this is part of a judgment oracle, where he's basically saying, look at all these horrible things that the Israelites are doing. They're worshiping false gods, and they're murdering, and they're stealing, and committing adultery, and bearing false witness, and doing all these horrible things. And they're saying, Yahweh is not going to punish us. The verse before, they say, we are safe. We are safe to do these detestable things. And then God kind of looks at them and says, are you? Are you really safe? Is my house a house full of thieves in your eyes? Is this sort of behavior acceptable? So Jesus references both of them. And in this case, I mean, that seems to me like he's pretty well keeping those verses in their original context. He's saying, Isaiah says this is what the temple should be, and you are turning it into what the people in Jeremiah's day did, a den of robbers. So I think that's a really solid example of New Testament quotes the Old Testament and keeps it pretty well in context.
Yeah, and like Jason said, it's a different, the same context, but it's a different application of it. And so Jeremiah is not talking about the people of Jesus's time, but Jesus is saying, you guys are looking a lot like this. And so it builds onto it a little bit, and that's kind of the next one that we wanted to talk about. Jason, there's an example here of how to maintain, or the Old Testament passage being maintained but increased. Do you want to talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, and before I do, I just want to note back on what Martin just said, that yes, like Jesus is not saying Isaiah and Jeremiah were writing to the people in the temple that he was chewing out, but he is saying, like, your ancestors were held to this standard because they were Jews. They were people of the covenant, people chosen by Yahweh. You're being held to the same standard and you're failing just like they did, which is a recurring theme in the gospel and Acts, is like your ancestors were sinners and you're sinners. Like your daddy was a loser. You were a loser. Your granddaddy was a loser. Like that's just kind of this recurring like insult and like recurring line of judgment that's given by Jesus and by his early apostles to these rebellious people, these people who are rebelling against Yahweh while still claiming his name. So yeah, the example that I have here of like maintaining something and then increasing it, like stacking up on it and saying, not only do you have to do what the Old Testament says, but you have to do even more because you're a Jesus follower now. Really easy verse. If you're going to memorize one verse today, Exodus chapter 20, verse 13, one of the 10 commandments, you shall not murder. Four words in English. Don't murder. Don't kill people in cold blood. Okay, that's fine. We agree on that. Even secular people generally agree. Murder is a bad thing. Like that does not require a whole lot of thought, insight, or philosophy. Well, Jesus quotes it in Matthew 5 quite famously and says, that isn't enough. He says in verse 21 and onwards, Matthew 5, verse 21 and onwards, you have heard that it was said to the people long ago, you shall not murder. And anyone who murders will be subject to judgment. Now, here he's quoting the verse, you shall not murder. And he's adding the rabbinic commentary on it. Anyone who does commit murder will be subject to judgment. And there's other like Levitical laws that are laid out that explain to you when someone kills someone, this is what happens. There's a law in another section of Exodus talking about like, well, if someone dies because of your negligence, actually there's a few different ones. One has to do with how you build your house. Another one has to do with how you handle your ox, like if your ox gores someone. And there's like slightly different rules depending on what happens, whether or not the murder was actually murder or like manslaughter. There's a bunch of different stuff that goes on. But the rabbinic teaching is anyone who murders will be subject to some form of appropriate judgment. Like that is the summary. Jesus continues on. But I tell you, so you've heard it said, but I say to you, anyone who is angry with a brother or sister will be subject to judgment. And again, anyone who says to a brother or sister, rakah, which means like moron or idiot, is answerable to court. And anyone who says you fool will be in danger of the fire of hell. So he's saying here, if you are even angry with your brother or sister and you bear that anger, you do not resolve it as you should, then you're still guilty. You're guilty just like a murderer is guilty. And if you insult them, how much more? And so he just kind of builds this like building argument. So he takes the original verse, don't kill people, and then says, actually, there's an even higher standard than don't kill. You should also not be angry with people. You should also not insult or slander them. So he's taking that base and he's like building a tower of additional rules on top of it. And he does this a ton in the Sermon on the Mount.
Jason's aware of this or not, but I love the Sermon on the Mount. Like when I started reading the Bible for myself, this was the first thing that I read because I was like, I love having a rule book. Like I like to know what I want, what I need to do. And then as I got older and learned how I was supposed to read my Bible, I learned, oh, it's not a rule book. And he's actually condemning people for that. Whoops. Because the whole Sermon on the Mount, essentially, from my reading, really revolves around a statement earlier. It's when Jesus says to be the salt of the earth and the light to the world. And you can see Jesus taking the teachings of the Jews and saying, this is how you're supposed to do this to be a light to the world. This is how you're supposed to do this as an example for the rest of the world. And it basically all boiled down to, you followed the rules really well, but you didn't love each other. And that's how a lot of the Sermon on the Mount ends up going, is you followed the rules, you didn't love each other. And so, like, this one, for example, I also just did today, if any of you guys have Right Now Media, Albert Tate just put a series on Right Now Media through the Ten Commandments, and he talks about this one really well. Basically, through all of these, right, he's saying, you were told this, you were given this rule, and this time, it's not murder each other, right? And you can check it off. Awesome. I haven't murdered anyone today. Go me. Pat myself on the back. Whatever. And Jesus says, you shouldn't be patting yourself on the back. That's like the bare minimum. What I've actually asked you to do is to love each other. And he goes through and he does this with, I think, the rest of the Ten Commandments. I think he might miss one or two. But he goes through and does, you were told this. My favorite one is when he talks about adultery. He says, you were told not to cheat on your wife. Way to go, buddy. You didn't do it. And then he says, but I tell you that if you look at another woman lustfully, you have committed adultery with her in your heart. And that's where we get that whole, like, pornography is really bad thing, because we realize it's not just about the act. It's about how we look at things. It's about how we see other people, right? And then Jesus continues and says, if your eye causes you to sin, gouge it out, which is like a super messed up way to fix that. And so we know he's, you know, not telling you to literally pull your eyes out. And he says, if your hand causes you to sin, chop it off, because it's better for you to lose something than to spend eternity in hell. He says all of this, right? And he goes through and he keeps doing the same thing. This is a pattern, actually, that Jason talked about. This I've heard, but I tell you this. And that's kind of how we get the whole this is being built up thing. It's the pattern that Jesus uses. It's the way that he actually talks about it, which is really cool. I love all of these passages, and I think they're phenomenal. But I'm just a nerd. So what about fulfilling prophecy, Jason? We have a couple of examples here of prophecies that are being fulfilled. Why don't we talk a little bit about Isaiah chapter 9? Because that's one that we talk about a lot as Christians.
Yeah. Fulfilling prophecy is tricky, because, like, who gets to decide when a vague sounding prophecy is fulfilled or not? And, like, everyone has that one, like, cousin or uncle or whatever that's, like, insane. And they're the ones that, like, you know, they're at a family gathering and they have too many drinks and they start telling you, like, you know, the government's putting computer chips in your neck when you're born and stuff like that, right? And they're like saying, oh, you know, Nostradamus knew this was going to happen, and starts talking how Nostradamus had all these prophecies and he knew he could see the future or whatever, right? Or you have that friend from college that, like, goes to a psychic and is convinced that the psychic knows, like, everything about them and can read their mind and tell their future. They're, like, weirdly into tarot cards and astrology or whatever. Like, we all know those people. And those people thrive on super vague, like, vague prophecies with vague fulfillments. So, like, Nostradamus says something about two towers and someone's like, he was talking about 9/11. I knew it. And it's like, that makes no sense. But okay, whatever. Whatever you want to believe, I guess I can't force you to make sense. I'll still argue against it, but I can't force you.
Regardless. Might have been talking about Lord of the Rings. Who knows?
Yeah, who knows? Maybe Nostradamus knew about Tolkien. Anyways. There are some issues with prophecies, even in scripture, that are fairly vague, but there are other ones that are very much not. And traditional Jewish interpretations took whatever prophecy and applied it to, say, the coming of the Messiah. And then at a popular level, all different sects of Jews, all different thoughts and schools of teaching were saying this is about the Messiah. So we have a few examples of that, like Isaiah 9, which people love bringing up, which is noted in the Targum, which is a traditional, more or less authoritative set of like rabbinic commentary on the Old Testament. And it's noted in the Targum as being a messianic prophecy. So they said, yes, this is about the coming Messiah that we are waiting for. Isaiah 9, 6 and 7 says this, "For to us a child is born, to us a son is given, and the government or authority will be on his shoulders. And he will be called Wonderful Counselor, Mighty God, Everlasting Father, Prince of Peace." There's a little bit of a controversy about how to translate that, but we won't get into it today. "Of the greatness of the government and his peace, there will be no end, and he will reign on David's throne and over his kingdom, establishing it and upholding it with justice and righteousness. From that time on and forever, the zeal of the Lord Almighty will accomplish this." This is a passage that Jews and Christians agree this is messianic. However, Christians say this is messianic and Jesus fulfilled it. And Jewish apologists will take this verse and say, well, there's no one currently sitting on the throne of David. So like on this earth, there's no one sitting on the throne of David, so it can't be fulfilled. Christians will respond and say, no, Jesus is sitting on the throne of David, but he is currently in this realm that we refer to as heaven, this place where God dwells in a special tangible way. He is in heaven and in the eschaton, in the last age, heaven and earth will become the same place, what Revelation calls the new heavens and the new earth, and Jesus will reign on earth. So he's currently on the throne of David, but the throne of David is just not right in front of us. And so there's this argument where Jews say this passage, this prophecy, which is fairly specific, is not fulfilled yet. And Christians say, no, it is fulfilled. You just don't like the way it was fulfilled. And so there's this argument between Christian and Jewish apologists about this. That's one great example of where prophecy can get messy. Like, is it fulfilled? Is it not? How do we qualify that? But also, like, no one's arguing that this is about the Messiah. Like, everyone agrees it definitely is.